Good evening, everyone. Welcome. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This course will last more than an hour tonight. We have so much content, so I hope everyone can stay a little longer. I'm going to start with a clinical pearl on omega-3 fatty acids in breast cancer. And then we have a follow-up case from Judy Pruszynski. And then there's a lot of questions from all of you. And I have some journal articles that I might not get to because we have so much other stuff, but I encourage you to look at it in the notes for this call. And let me get started right away since we have a lot. And remind you, you're all muted right now. And if you want to speak, you press star 7. In between the sections and my speaking, I will pause and give you all an opportunity to ask questions. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about omega-3 fatty acids and breast cancer. Omega-3 fatty acids have been a strong interest of mine since I was in graduate school, and I think they're really important in so many ways. They're not really enough omega-3s in the modern diet, whereas we have a high need for omega-3s. I think most people need to supplement to get to a healthy level, let alone a therapeutic level that we might want to think about in cancer patients. So the first slide, and just to remind you, you all should have gotten access to the notes and the slides for this call so that you can have them in front of you. I've found a few things I have to edit, so I will. So bear with the typos. So on the first slide is just a nice handout, kind of something to show to patients sometimes, but to remind ourselves of the importance of omega-3 fatty acids and monounsaturates in the diet, and that we want to emphasize those to our patients and teach them about de-emphasizing omega-6 relative to omega-3, and to encourage them not to eat saturated fat, tell them where that comes from, et cetera, so that for patients who aren't taking supplements, they are not eating a diet that's got too many omega-6 and not enough omega-3, which of course leads to most of the chronic diseases in the United States today. The second slide is a reminder of the basic biochemistry of the omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids to just remind you that linoleic acid is an omega-6, and that goes through a series of enzymatic transformations, and it then ends up being arachidonic acid, which, although it's a building block of and has certain healthy functions, it's very pro-inflammatory. It becomes leukotrienes and prostaglandins, so we want to try and de-emphasize inflammatory actors in this. Remember that vegetable oils and safflower oils, plant oils, typically are going to be rich in omega-6. And then depending on how an animal was raised, it might be high in omega-3 or omega-6, depending what that animal was fed. If it was fed grain, it's going to be high in omega-6. And if it's grass-fed and free-range, then it's going to be high in omega-3. So we're a little confused about what food is in the United States. So we have to teach patients that as well. Now, the omega-3 fatty acids pathway starts with alpha-linoleic acid, and that also can be found in many plants. A lot of green leafy vegetables have small amounts. Flax and chia seeds, canola oil, walnuts, soybean oil also are sources of alpha-linoleic acid, and the oily fish, krill oil, algae oil are the beginning of the eicosapentaenoic omega-3 oils that are found in fish, and this pathway ends up at DHA. And so most of our supplements contain EPA and DHA, eicosapentaenoic acid, and docosahexaenoic acid. And in the diet, most people get these from oily cold water fish like cod and salmon and sardines and mackerel, and then in supplements, krill oil and algae oil, although they are not very concentrated compared to fish oil. They do satisfy people who don't want to take fish oils or can't. So on slide, the next slide, number four, there's a lot of references on this. So I wanted to put statements and really good references here for you. And so this is a great paper, Implications of Dietary Omega-3 and Omega-6 Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids in Breast Cancers. Great paper. And it really talked about how whether you have more omega-6 or omega-3, you will either activate carcinogenic events or prevent them. And so that's really what we're going to talk about. It's a great paper. It's worth reading. Slide number five, the next slide is an expansion of these omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids pathways. But you will see that, especially if you have a color copy in front of you, that there are inflammatory fatty acids and their intermediates. There are anti-inflammatory, and then there are pro-resolving, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Those ones are in green on this, and primarily we'll look at resolvins and protectins and maresins, which are just intermediaries of the omega-3 fatty acid pathway. And so you can see that there's a lot of players, many different molecules that can either tip into inflammation or resolution of inflammation, that can build healthy cell walls or unhealthy cell walls. And one of my main interests in the omega-3s is that they build a healthy cell membrane, a healthy cell wall that's flexible and fluid and has these lipid rafts in it that float around and aren't brittle. And so the receptors are able to bind because they can wiggle and move. And the pores in the cell membrane can allow minerals to flow through and signaling molecules. And the transduction signaling is much more healthy and normal. And so you get better binding of signaling molecules, of hormones, of neurotransmitters, et cetera. So what really gives us a more efficient, normal, responsive physiology is having these flexible cell membranes that are made out of these wonderful omega-3 fats. So I always tell patients you can build a new body and a new brain by shifting the fats you eat to be predominantly omega-3s. Now, we're really not able to synthesize the EPA, DHA, long-chain omega-3s very efficiently. So if we want to get to therapeutic levels in our bodies for working with patients with pathologies like cancer, supplements are going to be required to do that. For health, you could potentially eat 2 grams of omega-3s a day, but the modern diet's kind of hard to do that, sort of my minimum. But we can teach patients how to optimize their dietary intake. Now, there's a paper on slide number 7 and 3 more references that I wanted to bring your attention to, that all of these papers show that omega-3 fatty acids are correlated with higher levels are correlated with less cancer risk, lower levels of omega-3s are associated with cancer development. And there's a number of papers that talk about that here, and I have listed them for you, the most recent of which is titled Implications of Dietary Omega-3 and 6 Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids in Breast Cancer. There's a paper there with breast and colorectal cancer, quite an old paper in 1999, but some of these old papers teach us the basic science. And then there's a 2013 paper, Current Evidence Linking Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids with Cancer Risk and Progression. Plenty of supportive data. Now, on slide number 8, I've listed all the great things that having optimized omega-3 fatty acids provide to the tumor microenvironment and to the physiology. So this isn't just about cancer. This is also about all the ways that these functions are the omega-3s promote many types of health. So just keep in mind, we're talking about breast cancer, but this list of the functions of omega-3, the benefits of optimized omega-3 apply to many other settings and functions. So we know that they lower inflammation, COX-2, LOX-5, prostaglandin E2, interleukin 1 and 6, TNF-alpha, CRP. All of these are ramped up in the cancer physiology, and we can measure any of those, and we do track them in our biomarker tracking. There is an inhibition of both metastasis and angiogenesis and a promotion of apoptosis with the omega-3s, so this is our goal. There's also an inhibition of many kinases that activate pro-tumorigenic carcinogenic pathways, like the protein kinase C and the BCL2 and the RAS oncogene. These are promoted, and these are going to create a proliferative environment and an environment in which progression and metastasis can occur. Very interesting about optimized omega-3s, chemosensitizer, radiosensitizer. So this helps patients to have a better response to the difficult treatments they're asked to do. There's some impact on the promotion of the more protective hydroxyestrogen metabolites found in the urine. There is an inhibition of platelet aggregation and thrombin formation. Remember that the tumor microenvironment is inherently one of hypercoagulation, and this produces a risk for cancer patients. 40% of cancer patients will form a thrombus that damages their health and well-being through a stroke or a heart attack or a leg or a pulmonary venous embolism. So managing and monitoring platelet aggregation, including things that decrease it, are important in cancer patients for their safety. But the increased thrombin and fibrin that goes in the hypercoagulation environment also is how cancer cells hide from the immune system. So they wear their little raincoat made out of fibrin, and medications and botanicals can't find the receptors. The immune system can't see these cells. So the management of the pro-coagulation environment is very important to patients' outcomes and their response to therapies. As I said, normal cell membranes are one of the big gifts of this that leads to normal membrane functioning and normal receptor binding. Promotion of tumor suppressor gene PTEN, and in that same pathway is the tumor promoter mTOR. So we want to also think about turning on the tumor suppressor and turning off the tumor promoter. So the omegas do this, and so does, if you'll remember, Hinokiol. We have a whole Grand Rounds call, Clinical Pearl, on Hinokiol, the phytochemical from Chinese magnolia bark. There's an inhibition of multi-drug resistance. This is primarily due to the kinase signaling and the normal membrane. Having normal healthy membrane. I use high doses of the omega-3s in patients with cachexia to turn down some of the extreme inflammation and inhibit the proteolysis-inducing factor that is activated in cachexia and causes a rapid decline in patients. And then its benefit to the brain, which is built out of fats, to normalize mood regulation. Also decreases seizure risk and membrane thresholds as well. So, you know, if there was a drug that did all of this and it was safe to take every single day, it would be the headlines. So we have to recognize how wonderful this is. On slide number 9, there is an infographic there from a great paper showing how the healthy membrane built out of the omega-3s actually changes expression of many mediators of inflammation and of also of carcinogenesis. So you can see the downregulation of NF-kappa-B, the downregulation of prostaglandin E2, of the RAS gene, of insulin-like growth factors and growth factor receptors, of the epidermal growth factor receptor. These are targets for cancer drugs and treatments. So if we can target them with omega-3s, then we have a safe way to do that. The next slide, number 10, is a fantastic infographic. You could just memorize this and you'd understand omega-3s. So in the middle is this gray horizontal bar that represents the plasma membrane. And then you can see that there are receptors in the membrane, those boxes. And then you can also see then how building a membrane out of these fats creates a lipid raft that actually is more flexible and more functional. And then you can see how DHA in green and EPA and DHA in purple change all these functions that I just listed for you. And so this just gives you a sense of whether that's happening at the receptor site in the membrane, if it's a transduction signal, or if it's happening in the cytosol. And so because there's an influence on apoptosis, then we also have mitochondrial signaling as well. So there are a lot of pathways. Like all these wonderful pleomorphic multitasker molecules from nature, they do a lot of things. So the next two slides are representative of research and studies. This comes from a review article showing the principal mechanisms of omega-3s that are protective in breast cancer. And then the following slide shows the principal mechanisms related to the pro-carcinogenic effects of the omega-6 in breast cancer. And so it's pretty stunning, the if you look at both of these slides, how protective the omega-3s are, and therefore to really be able to help patients switch their physiology to be more dominating in the omega-3s than the omega-6s, which again is hard to do with modern diet and with the way agribusiness makes food in America. So all of the things that we listed before are listed here, but they're split up really in to show you that the omega-6s also are pro-carcinogenic, right? Pro-carcinogenic. And so you want to be mindful of that and see what genes that they are turning on. The omega-6s aren't all bad. They're not all bad. But for the characteristics and hallmarks of cancer that we focus on in this course, you want to be really clear where the leverage is for those main drivers of cancer characteristics that allow them to survive. So the omega-3s really help us to protect the physiology from the flourishing of cancer cells. Now, slide number 13 is a study showing some of the impact on immunology, and it's a great study. It was done for 8 years on women with metastatic breast cancer. 40% of them had three or more metastatic sites. They were given 1.8, a little under 2 grams a day. That's kind of my bottom, that dose. Most of my patients get 4, 6, 10, depending what they need and can tolerate. So this study over 8 years showed no DHA-related adverse events, some transformation of resistant, treatment-resistant tumor cells to become treatment-sensitive. So that's significant in metastatic patients because the treatment resistance is part of the problem at that stage of cancer. And then increased overall survival and increased time to recurrence. So I put the two graphs of that in next. Slide 14 shows you overall survival with the patients that got high DHA versus low DHA. Visually, it's pretty clear. You can see there's considerable increase, almost double the number of months, 18 to 34 months, 18 in the low DHA group and 34 months overall survival in the DHA supplemented group. And then the next slide shows the time to progression, which is a lot where we have leverage in both these places, is helping patients live longer and hopefully live healthier during these periods of time. So improving overall survival, but we also, our approach also really lengthens out time to progression. And so this chart shows the impact of just DHA, right? Just DHA. So it's pretty significant. The next couple of slides are talking about the impact of omega-3 fatty acids on the inflammatory environment in the tumor cell and whether or not that tumor cell is has the more inflammatory types of macrophages or the inflammation inhibitory tumor-associated macrophages. And so this study shows that if you have different lipid milieu, you'll have different immunity and inflammation in the tumor cells. So this next slide, 17, I think it's a little confusing, but let me tell you my color coding I put on it. So for tumor suppression, the stop sign for cancer, I put red highlights. So both a box around the M1 tumor-associated cell and the in red text, how tumors regress in the presence of M1, because it's, you have healthier functioning dendritic cells mobilizing immunity. You have functioning cytotoxic T cells that haven't been suppressed. You have Th1 helper cells, and you have the M1 tumor-associated macrophages. That is an environment that is taking control of progression. On the other hand, if you have a transformation of the M1 to M2, you're in a tumor promoter physiology. And if you put omega-3s into that environment, then they act as mediators, and you get this presence of the resolvins, neuroprotectants, and myrcins that starts to resolve that inflammation and move it back to a tumor suppressor profile. So the next slide is really the same thing with a little bit more types of cells there. So you see on the left, if you have immune activation and a tumor-associated macrophage top M1 and more T helper cells than T1 helper cells, you can have control of this environment. However, if you have an excess of the type 2 tumor-associated macrophages, you will have also more of the immunosuppressive type of T cells. And so then in that environment, you don't have control, you have growth and progression. And so the omega-3s push us back to the type M1 immune competent, low inflammation microenvironment. So that is the impact of the omega-3s. And in this more complex slide and in the reference here, you can find descriptions of all these cells and their functions. And so it's a good look at a tumor microenvironment and what happens when we manipulate it in the favor of our patients with something safe they can take every single day. The next slide, number 19, is one of a phase 2 trial. This reflects a prior study that I just mentioned, showing that metastatic breast cancer patients can have better outcomes with omega-3s, and that patients who are treatment resistant can be again sensitized, have their tumor cells resensitized to chemotherapy, and they can then get some benefit again from chemo. The next slide, number 20, is a very recent study, and I really like this study. It looked at the effects of omega-3 supplementation on Ki-67 and VEGF. And so Ki-67, you'll see this in pathology reports, it is a measure of the aggressiveness of the tumor cell line that patient has. How fast is it dividing? And so if you have fast dividing cells, you need to intervene with an appropriate plan now. Whereas you have lazy cells, you can have milder, less toxic treatments, take your time and understand you have a sleepy tumor that's not like running like wildfire. Similarly, if the tumors are not expressing vascular endothelial growth factor, which allows tumor cells to produce blood capillaries and their own blood supply, and then provides a highway for metastasis. So if you have low proliferative rate, if you slow down the Ki-67, reduce the proliferative rate, and if you inhibit VEGF, that really puts the brakes and slows down the progression. So that's a pretty big thing for omegas to do. But the previous studies demonstrated that. Those graphs demonstrated that. So this is also a study where half the participants had the omega-3s with their neoadjuvant chemo and half didn't. And the ones that received the omega-3s did much better because of the change in those traits of the cells. Now, there is an ongoing trial right now that I'm going to track and follow, and it's comparing using DHA with the neoadjuvant chemotherapy versus patients and neoadjuvant chemotherapy without DHA, another trial of that type. This one's a phase 2, and it has more participants in it. So there's interest. There's interest in the medical community looking at this. So those are the big ideas. I wanted to bring your attention on slide 22 to the best test for assessing the omega status of our patients, and introduce you to Dr. Bill Harris, whose name is on here. He is the expert, considered one of the main experts on omega-3s in the United States. And his website is omegaquant.com, and he designed this test. It's just a finger stick test, and it produces what he calls the omega-3 index, which instead of measuring your serum levels of omega-3s and omega-6s, it analyzes your membrane and what is the percentage of omega-3s in your cell membranes. And he says that's a better way to determine if someone actually has a healthy status. So it's not an expensive test. The lowest price is $49. It just gives you that omega-3 index. If you want to know more about trans fats and a full fatty acid profile and personalized dietary recommendations, it's $99. So it's not too much for the patient, and they'll mail the kit to the patient. And so I think that's great. And then you can adjust the dose of the omega-3s with your patient and then test again in 6 months and see if you improved it. And you'll know if the cell membrane changed, you know, the brain changed too. You know that all those receptor binding changed. You know there is really good inflammation control once you see that. So that is that's the last content slide. The final slide is just a repeat of all the functions to remember all these wonderful functions that omega-3s do, and to remind you that I recommend a minimum of 2 grams a day. Most cancer patients, I have them on 4 to 6 grams a day. You don't want to anticoagulate your patients. Remember that omega-3s inhibit platelet aggregation, so you need to tailor the dose to the patient. That is my presentation on that. And I like to use Designs for Health OmegaVail TG1000. It's a triglyceride form of omega-3 DHA, EPA DHA mix. I like the triglyceride form. It's more stable. It oxidizes less slowly. But Zymogen also has a newer kind of supplement where you don't have to take as much in the supplement, and you do get more higher blood levels. I forget what it's called. So I'll stop here, and people can press *7 if you want to ask questions. You can unmute yourself and ask questions about this.
Hey, Nalini, it's Judy.
Hello, Judy.
Hi. KI67, when would one see this? You said we'd see it in reports.
Pathology. It's always on a pathology report.
It's always in a pathology report.
It should be. It should be. Yeah. Okay. So let's say you're looking at a breast cancer pathology report. You're trying to find out if it's estrogen receptor positive or not. You will see. That's where you see the Bloom-Richardson score. You'll see staging. You'll see proliferative rate. That's KX. 67. So it's usually a biopsy report or a surgical tissue report.
Okay, great.
It's useful information because it tells you about the aggressiveness and the replication rate of the cancer.
Thank you.
Yeah. So anyway, your case is next, but let me see if anybody else has a question on the omega-3s. Nope. We have people from all over California, the East Coast, the Midwest, the South. This is great. All right. So Judy presented a follow-up on a patient that she had originally presented, who is a colorectal cancer patient who was originally diagnosed in 2017, had a resection, had chemotherapy, and has progressed with liver metastasis, and that is the present tense. And I believe at this stage, given your notes, has probably completed or is in a course of chemotherapy, which includes Avastin right now. This man is also hypertensive. He's interested in going outside the country or to some outside-the-box cancer clinics, And so your main questions, or his main questions, are what are the best therapies in addition to conventional chemotherapy? And he's considering ISILs and Hope for Care treatment centers in Mexico, and then the Reno treatment center. I forgot to write that in the notes, but I know it's in yours. So let me just answer that question right now. I've never had a good experience with any clinic in Mexico ever, and I've had bad experiences with them. And the only clinic I feel any little bit comfortable with is Senovive, and that is only because Paul Anderson, who is a brilliant naturopathic oncologist, consults for them, but he doesn't actually see patients. And as I shared with Kirsten today, my wonderful, wonderful functional nutritionist, I shared with her that my experience of these clinics is no matter what's happening with you, they put you through the same program. So, and the quality of medical care is pretty shoddy, in my opinion. So I'm not comfortable sending patients there. So so ISILs is in California. I actually don't know too much about them. I have looked at their site many times, and my feeling is that what they're doing there, they've been doing the same thing for a long time, and so why haven't they updated what they're doing? So I don't know enough to really render a real opinion, and I don't know anyone who's gone there. I do know patients who have gone to these Mexican clinics.
What about the Reno one, Nalini, because that's the one he's zeroing in on.
Okay, so if the Reno one is Michael Gerber and Sean Devlin, they're fantastic doctors. They're both brilliant. So if that's the clinic he's looking at, there's a couple there up in Reno. So if that's not their clinic, then Michael Gerber and Sean Devlin, D-E-V-L-I-N, are in Reno. They share a clinic. They are, both of them are geniuses. And they do a lot of outside-the-box things, but they really keep patients safe, and they're good clinicians. So if he's looking, that's a place nearby. If he wants to go outside the country, I have listed a couple of clinics in Germany and Austria and Turkey that I know are good. I always like people to stay close to home, though, if they can, and because a lot of times it's patients with advanced disease. It means they're away from their families. It means maybe they'll die far away from their families, and so I prefer people to be close to home. I really, really, really prefer that. And here in California, where your patient is, up in San Francisco, Zen Hospice has trained a lot of people in end-of-life care. I wouldn't be surprised if they had an outpost or someone trained by them in Santa Cruz. And so they're just great when you get to the point where you want to make sure he has supportive, compassionate care. So why am I saying that? Because when a colorectal cancer patient gets liver metastasis, it's really hard to control the disease. So the reason that colorectal cancer patients metastasize to the liver is because of the hepatic portal vein. It's a big highway from the intestines to the liver, and then you end up in the liver, this incredibly vascular place from which more metastasis is possible, or there's just enough nutrients there for tumors to establish and grow. And so it's tough. So I think, for example, I have an advanced cancer patient right now. She's an ovarian cancer patient, but she's becoming treatment resistant. So I was talking to my colleague, Nasha Winters, wonderful naturopathic oncologist, and she has developed a protocol, which I'm having this patient do next month, of getting whole body hyperthermia every single day, and on that same day, getting an IV mistletoe treatment. And those two things together, Nasha feels, resets the immune system and allows the chemotherapy, or in this case, PARP inhibitor, to be resensitized and transforms the immune system in many other ways as well. So that's something to think about. If he can't do all of that, IV mistletoe, I think, or subcutaneous mistletoe is something a patient can do at home and fills the niche of immunotherapy in a protocol. I think that's good. I'm a fan of high-dose IV vitamin C if someone has healthy enough kidneys, isn't diabetic, and you test their genetics to make sure they won't, their red blood cells won't lyse. You test the gene G6PD on them to find out. And I'm a fan of using hyperthermia and mistletoe together. And then on top of that, you can do something cytotoxic. So those, there's immunotherapy in the mistletoe. There's cytotoxicity in IV vitamin C. And then you can do oral cytotoxic things as well, like Natura Health products, Phytocyto is a great product by Donnie Yance. And put that together with an artemisinin product to stress the tumor cell even more. And so that's nice. High-dose melatonin therapy. I've seen patients take 80 milligrams two or three times a day as a cancer treatment. You have to monitor them. I also really like to use Pectisol C, the modified citrus pectin, because it's really great with the metastatic disease because it starts to bind up a lot of that sticky stuff and cells that are in the bloodstream. Oops, that should not be on. Okay, sorry. So I like to see patients combine something that mobilizes the immune system, something cytotoxic. They have access to IV therapies. There's nothing more powerful. You can't accomplish blood levels orally that you can accomplish with IV. And then looking at what you could do in his cancer terrain. So you might ramp up his omegas and use things like Boswellia, which is really great for colorectal cancer. And curcumin, might want to ramp those doses up and ramp up the doses of the Chinese mushrooms. And if his bone marrow has been suppressed by his prior treatments, support that with something like Marrow Plus by Health Concerns. So like those are the things you want to think about right now. If he can do far infrared saunas, he can do that. To also, I noticed, I didn't remember, but he has heavy metal toxicity. So a gentle way for him to get some out of his system would be to do some far infrared saunas in combination with some of Chris Shade's Quicksilver supplements that mobilize the bile and then bind up what's excreted in the bile and the stool. And you might want to look at that if he's robust enough to do that and has access to a far infrared sauna. But the rest of the protocol that I gave you before kind of is the same, but now we want to think about where can we be more aggressive? Maybe how can we unburden him from some of those heavy metals that might be obstructing his own immune capacity and his mitochondria? And what can we do that's more cytotoxic and augment what the oncologist wants to do? Or if he wants to step out of that, then I think mostly what Michael Gerber and Sean Devlin are doing is hyperthermia and low-dose chemotherapy and ozone therapy. I think that's a lot of what they're doing up there. And they do a lot of hyperthermia combined with low-dose chemotherapy in Europe. And so there's less toxicity, there's less resistance, and there's the mobilization of the immunity by the heat as well and the stress to the tumor cells by the heat. So those are things like that we don't do in our practices, but I definitely refer out if a patient has money and we're running out of aggressive therapies to do. You always have to think about what most of what we do is managing the tumor microenvironment and trying to put a wall against progression and then promote health. But we're not killing cancer cells with the tumor microenvironment management. So there, you need to pulse that the same way that chemotherapy is pulsed. With something, right? So do you want to say anything more about this patient, Judy?
I'd like to ask, I'm actually encouraged. I'm thinking that the place in Reno is the one that the two guys, the Michael and Sean, because I'd just like to read through a list of 11 therapies that they do there and see if that sparks anything for you.
Yeah, okay.
Because one of them is the ozone, is the hypothermia and the mistletoe.
Uh-huh.
So then the other ones are dendritic cell vaccines, UV blood irradiation, poly-MVA, GCMAV. Selenium. B17 ozone and oxygen therapies, insulin potentiation therapy, platelet-rich plasma therapy.
Yeah, all of those things. I love all those therapies. I love all of them.
I think he's onto it then. Great.
Okay.
Great.
There's a couple other clinics that do all that up there in Reno. So make sure, because I know Michael Gerber and I know Sean Devlin, and they're good docs. And the other clinics, I don't like the docs there so much, even though they do the same therapies. So, and a lot of those therapies, like, are taught by Paul Anderson. He, I have a whole book of his protocols that he does, and he gets amazing results. And so, and Sean Devlin, Sean is just so, such a great doctor. He's a naturopath, and I'm an osteopath, I think. And then Michael Gerber is, I don't know, he's probably in his late 70s now. He was my doctor in Mill Valley, California, when I was in my 20s. He's an amazing doctor. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Anything else?
No, thank you very much.
All right. Does anybody else want to ask questions about this case or have any brilliant ideas? I know that was kind of fast, but I want to get to everybody's questions. So let me do that. And the links and the names of these European clinics are also in the notes. All right. Let me find the rest of my notes here. So there were some really great questions. So let me go through those. We had Isabel Galliano had two questions. She asks great questions. So what are your tips on how to handle peripheral neuropathy? I think I've spoken to this in a couple of other clinical pearls, like when I talked about how to manage side effects of carboplatin. Neuropathy is a big side effect of the platinum drug. So with, in addition to what I'm going to say now, you might want to look at that clinical pearl as well. So the damage to neurons is primarily due to oxidative stress. And so the solution is to quench the oxidative stress and provide the building blocks for healthy neurons and healthy myelin sheaths. So that's, those are the big principles to achieve. And, of course, since neurons are also sensitive to other toxins and other oxidative stress besides their cancer treatment, you want to make sure that the patient's aware that, of that, and they take them out. Like, I had a breast cancer patient who had severe neuropathy for 8 years after her successful breast cancer treatment, and she was a smoker, you know, so there was no way that extra oxidation was and redox reaction was ever going to get quenched. So it just kept going around in a circle and self-feeding itself. And so I didn't get her to completely stop smoking, but this is the protocol we did on her. And in 8 weeks, 8 years of peripheral neuropathy that was debilitating to her went away forever. So I'm going to tell you what I did on her. And, you know, you don't have to do everything, but these are the tools I find most useful. And when I have a patient on a chemotherapy regimen that does produce neuropathy, I will put a little bit of these things or even all of them in to try and protect the nerves and repair them as we go along. And if you're concerned about interfering with the chemo, then you just do this on the off week. You can have the patient do acupuncture in the middle and just have plenty of color in their diet so they're getting plant antioxidants. So, you know, remove any other sources of high oxidative stress that they might need, might not. I'm so sorry. I keep thinking I turned my phone off. All right. It is now off. All right. So, what you want to do is really look at all their exposures and inflammation, because remember that inflammation is also a contributor to increasing oxidative stress. So that's our patients, right? So we have a good plan. You want to make sure that the patient is aware that iron is pro-oxidative. And so make sure they're not eating red meat or having supplements that have added iron to them, unless their iron needs to be repleted. So this is what I find works the best. The omega-3 fatty acids, at least 4 grams a day. Then acetyl L-carnitine and L-glutamine are my go-to. That's what I always put in. And they both come in powders. So if you've already given the patient a mountain of capsules, you can give these in powders. They can be put in a shake. Or some patients just like to do pills because they feel that it's easier to do all their pills altogether. So you need about 2 grams a day of acetyl L-carnitine and about 3 grams a day of L-glutamine. You spread that out into at least 2 doses. And then lipoic acid has been shown more to repair than prevent. So the first two do both. And so in diabetics, the lipoic acid has been shown to really be great for diabetic-associated neuropathies. But in practice, I find that the acetyl-L-carnitine, L-glutamine, omega-3 fatty acids, eating the rainbow in their diet and getting rid of other inflammation and sources of oxidative stress, plus acupuncture. I did weekly acupuncture on this woman. And, you know, if they're not digesting their fats, take care of that because they need to build a myelin sheath also and make sure their microbiome is in good shape. We know every patient we see needs microbiome help. Make sure that they're getting methylated B complex because that's required for normal neuronal health. So those are just the basics. And I find with most patients that is sufficient. It can take time, but you can repair the nerves. You absolutely can. So I don't know if Isabel's on the call. No. All right. So I'll carry on then. Does anybody want to ask a question or share what they do for peripheral neuropathy? Okay, so there was another question by from Isabel about patients who are BRCA1 and BRCA2 positive. What do I recommend to these patients? So I think all of us are more aware of BRCA1 and BRCA2 because it's just tested more today. And so there are patients, all breast cancer patients, especially those with a family history, should have this genetic testing. The BRCA genes are, when they're mutated, they are cells that are unable to protect their DNA, and so they have more breakage of their DNA, and it doesn't get repaired. And so these patients are very sensitive to oxidative stress and radiation exposure. So if we have breast cancer patients, I don't really want them having mammograms. I want them having MRIs without contrast and ultrasounds, if at all possible. I don't want them to have a lot of dental x-rays. I don't want them to have a chest x-ray just because their doctor wants to do it. There has to be a good reason. So you want to protect these patients, educate them to tell their doctors they're BRCA positive and they don't want any unnecessary radiation exposure. So that's really important. And because they're more vulnerable to oxidative stress, then, you know, we want them to eat lots and lots and lots of color as well so that they have a lot of natural antioxidants in their system. Now, niacinamide, which is a different molecule than nicotinic acid, which is what niacin is, niacinamide is a natural mild PARP inhibitor. PARP inhibitors are a major treatment in oncology for BRCA-positive patients. And so 2 grams a day is the dose. Douglas Lab makes a 500 milligrams, so the patient can take 2 twice a day. So giving them mild PARP inhibitor treatment with that. And even if they're on a PARP inhibitor, this goes through a different mechanism. So it's nice to just keep it in their plan. Now, remember that BRCA genes are not only in breast tissue. They're ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, colorectal cancer, and melanomas are associated with BRCA genes, both 1 and 2. And these cancers are much more aggressive. Most people who have this mutation have a family history. So when you take a history and you hear family history, you want to think maybe they have some BRCA involvement as part of the contributing factors. Now, women who are identified as BRCA positive are told to have double mastectomies and oophorectomies. And, you know, if medicine was designed by women, that wouldn't be the first recommendation, I don't think. So what I counsel these patients to do all the things that take control of the tumor microenvironment. So I've listed here, I'm not going to read to you everything, interventions and guidelines for these patients who need more screening. They need more genetic screening. They need more ultrasounds of their breasts and their ovaries and their pancreas. They need to be sure they do colonoscopies. They need to take advantage of that. And then they need to maybe talk to a genetic counselor and get more comprehensive genetic testing to see other ways that they're vulnerable. And so those are the main things. And they need to be educated in a way that they feel a sense of agency instead of feeling freaked out and anxious, which is how most patients feel. And there was a nice link I put in here, patient information on breast cancer genetics, that's on the breastcancer.org site, which is just like a great way to give a patient basic information. So here's what I say to young women who are told they're BRCA positive, told to neuter themselves and because they're BRCA positive. And then maybe they got the test because their mom or their grandmother had breast cancer and they want to find out if it was BRCA. And so they're young, they haven't had their kids. I tell them to have their kids. Have your kids. And then let's protect you from aggressive cancers. That's what I tell people. I think it's a terrible thing to just take that away from people. So if you're looking at someone who has a fairly healthy lifestyle, is willing to make the changes we teach our patients to do, willing to take supplements and herbs, then I tell them to have a baby or two. And if they are, you know, a smoker and they eat the standard American diet and they're pre-diabetic, you know, and they eat packaged food, well, they're at higher risk. And so there's other considerations there. So it's always, who are you talking to? But these patients will have dramatically higher risk of breast cancer. In the United States today, a woman who's not BRCA positive has a 12% risk, 1 in 8 women. But a BRCA positive woman with BRCA mutations has a 72% risk of breast cancer. And these are aggressive, difficult to treat breast cancers. So it's really tough. It's really, really tough to say, well, all we really have for you is to cut off the tissue we can cut off. But remember, these people can still get pancreatic and colorectal cancer. But these are bad cancers, and people die young of them. So I think you just have to talk to the patient about all of the options, and they have to live with the decision that they choose for themselves, basically. But, for example, women who get ovarian cancer and are BRCA positive are at very high risk to also develop breast cancer, and so they are counseled to get double mastectomies. So it's very tricky. We're not going to take people's pancreas out. We're not going to take their colon out. So it's very tricky, but these are bad cancers. I think it's good to be able to identify these patients. And then you maybe want to put them on a natural PARP inhibitor like niacinamide and really teach them how to take control of their tumor microenvironment. So just listed all the things on this these notes for this call. That you would teach your patient and support them and teach them how to keep those as lifelong habits that will keep them well screened and reduce their risk because of the physiology they create, creating a body where cancer is less likely to arise and proliferate and progress. But these are very high risk, and it's a very personal decision. It's a very, very personal decision. Also, men can be BRCA positive, so men get the short shrift on, they're usually not screened for the BRCA genes. They're usually not screened for osteoporosis and bone loss, but they get those too. Men get breast cancer. So we want to be mindful of making sure all our patients are protected. Does anyone want to ask about the BRCA genes?
Hi, this is Isabel Galliano.
Oh, you're here. Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm calling from Singapore.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So I couldn't get into the call for my first question regarding the neuropathy. I wanted to ask, how about massage on the fingers and toes and exercise and movement? Does that help in any way or not?
Well, anytime we bring more circulation to the extremities where the pathology is, of course, we're bringing more nutrients there. So I think it's fine. I don't think it's the big lever, but it's part of a health model, certainly.
Okay. And then regarding BRCA patients, as I mentioned in my question, I have more and more clients who don't have active cancer but are diagnosed with BRCA, with the BRCA gene. And usually the recommendation is that they should remove the ovary because it's more difficult to detect and it's much more aggressive. And there goes always the question, you know, at what age?
So I just talked about this. So if you just joined the call, I'm not going to say it again because everybody deserves it. But what I like to say is listen to everything I said. And then if you still have questions, ask the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have the notes for the call? Do you also have the notes for the call?
Yeah, yeah. And I did hear what you said.
Okay.
But I just wanted to ask if there is a certain age where it becomes more dangerous.
Well, a lot of these women get those cancers in their 30s. So if they're sitting in front of me and they're 29 or 30, I say, have your babies, and then we have to figure this out.
Okay.
But I don't want them to not have their babies and then go, well, you know, now I'm really in the high-risk age group, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's psychologically terrible to live with a 72% chance of a difficult-to-treat cancer that you might get in your 30s and die from. So mm-hmm. I think these are very personal decisions, you know, in that way.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, now we have another question from Kiran Sangha. And she says, do you have any advice or precautions around treating patients who have recently completed immunotherapy, such as a PD-1 inhibitor? Do I refrain from using anything that would potentially stimulate immunity? And if so, for how long? And then she says of herself, I'm always cautious as I've been taught not to use anything that could stimulate immunity, including melatonin mushrooms, probiotics, for up to 6 months after they have completed treatment. Okay, so great question because, you know, these immunotherapies are new, but they're being used in more and more of our patients, and they almost always create some kind of autoimmune disease or syndrome. I've seen most patients get colitis, thyroiditis, lung inflammation. So I've seen one patient have myocarditis. I've seen a patient get hepatitis. Of course, patients get joint pain. So you have to see what happens to each patient and the intensity of it also, because I really feel like I have one patient who really had a miracle result from taking Keytruda, and she had stage 4 endometrial cancer with lung metastasis. And she doesn't have any evidence of disease right now. None. Absolutely none. So that's been going on for 2 years, but she still has colitis. And I think she has it at a low level because we've managed it, and I'll tell you what we did for her. But I actually think the presence of that colitis is evidence that the immune system is still mobilized. So I don't really want to put a complete lid on it because that's just my conjecture. But I think that's evidence of the on switch that got turned on for her. And the problem with these drugs, and we do have more than one clinical pearl talking about immunotherapy. So you can listen to some of those. But the problem with these drugs is we don't know which patient's going to have a wildfire and which patient is going to have a little burning ember coal that's quite manageable to live with, and which patient's going to get full-blown autoimmune disease, and which patient is just going to get mild joint pain, for example. So you have to individualize this to the patient. I don't think there's a mark like 6 months where you can all of a sudden think that you can start using super strong immunostimulants. So I don't think that melatonin or probiotics are problematic in these patients. That's not my experience. But things like astragalus and all of the medicinal mushrooms, I'm very cautious with those. And what's interesting, although I've spoken about mistletoe as an immunotherapy and it does produce an inflammatory response, it treats autoimmune diseases quite well. And so does GC-MAF, which was mentioned by Judy in this clinic in Reno. So you can look for things that are good at treating both cancer and autoimmune disease. But I go back to the things that we know work. Omega-3 fatty acids, high doses of curcumin, high doses of boswellia. Those are like go-to things, and a diet that's anti-inflammatory and full of phytophenols. So I like to be able to have a plan before they take the drug to have some of those things in their system at pretty good doses. So we have something to modulate these drugs are so strong, we're not going to turn them off. But I'm trying to avoid the wildfire, which my patient had. She went to the emergency room more than once with severe watery diarrhea and colitis, unable to eat and losing weight, and her electrolytes off, so her heart rate was abnormal. Bad things can happen. So we have to monitor these patients well, because they don't always know what to do. And my experience, I shared this patient with a wonderful oncologist who's a researcher, and he gave her this drug that nobody else was using for these patients several years ago. And he didn't have a clue how to manage the autoimmune inflammation, because he's an oncologist, has no training in treating autoimmune patients. And so he was throwing these really super high doses of prednisone at her and then telling her to go off of them in 2 days. And I just finally said, can you let me manage that part? And we were all in this circular email, and he finally just said, do whatever Nalini says. I don't know what to do. So we can really make a difference, because in naturopathic medicine, we have good management of autoimmune disease. So you think about these patients as if they're autoimmune patients, because they are, and then you do the things that you would do for an autoimmune patient. You have to get their gut right, so you do have to use probiotics, but more important are prebiotics, so that their gut is an environment in which those healthy bacteria can flourish. So you just put the foundation for health in, have good inflammation management, take away all their triggers of inflammation from their diet and their chemical exposures and body care products, and watch them carefully, so that some patients at the 6 month mark are still quite inflamed. You can't relax your vigilance and just start throwing strong immune stimulants at these patients. You have to watch. Each patient is quite different in my experience. And I had one patient in the very early days of immunotherapy die of myocarditis from an immunotherapy drug. And the doctors don't admit that's what happened, but that is what happened. And so we need to be part of it, because we have these modulating botanicals and nutraceuticals like omega-3s, and we can smooth this out and help manage it. And so we need to be a part of the team and educate patients. All right. I put some statements, some notes about what to do with hyperinflammation and autoimmune syndromes and the herbs to avoid. So you'd also avoid echinacea, for example. I also put in a note that Chinese raw licorice root at a dose of 2 to 6 grams a day has mild anti-inflammatory steroid-like effects. And then you want to screen these patients for all these autoimmune symptoms, that because the oncologist often not screening the patient for their thyroid function, or asking them about joint pain, or asking them about heart rate. They're not looking for immune disease. They're not trained in it, but we are. So you want to make sure that you're asking all the questions and making sure that you get the whole picture, so that the patient needs an exam or needs a thyroid assessment, that they get it. So that's kind of my approach. We have another question, and this is going to be the last question, because it's 6:30, and then I'll quickly tell you about the published papers I want to bring to your attention. So Aniko Langell is a pharmacist, and she is very, very, very knowledgeable about all of these things. So she asks, what test do you recommend having done on a biopsy sample at the time of a recurrence, other than the usual pathology and DNA testing? Would I do chemosensitivity testing, for example? So there's a lot of answers to this question. So let's think of all the ways we could think about it and all the resources we might explore. So number one, do you have access to tissue? Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you only have a biopsy, which is usually not enough tissue, but maybe you can do some small testing. You would ask the pathologist that's holding the tissue for this patient, how much tissue is there? And then that guides what you think you can do. So let's say there isn't any tissue, or the biopsy sample is so small and it was all used up doing the pathology test. So then what do you want to think about? You could do a liquid biopsy, and you could think about doing circulating tumor cells, circulating tumor DNA, you could look at not only seeing if there are circulating tumor cells or in DNA, you could have those analyzed to see what kind of receptors are on those cells. So for example, I had a prostate cancer patient who was on hormone depletion therapy, and I did circulating tumor cells on him, and I found out that some of his cells were androgen receptor negative. So that meant the hormone therapy wasn't sufficient, that it was only going to have an impact on the cells with androgen receptors, and therefore we needed a plan to address the other population of cells that we wouldn't have known was there. So that's the value of doing that. If you have tissue, then you have to see when are you going to collect it. So if you're in a pre-op situation, then you can do tests that require live cells. So those are many of the chemosensitivity tests where they culture the cells in the lab, so they need live cells, and then they test different agents and different combinations of agents. So it depends when somebody comes in, but if they're planning to have a biopsy of a lymph node or something, then we can lobby for some of the tissue. And then you call the lab, you make sure the collection kit is couriered over to the surgeon who's going to collect the tissue, and that the surgeon has the kit in hand to collect the tissue. Usually the pathology department handles that. They make sure the kit is delivered to the surgeon in the room he's in or she's in, and then the sample in that kit goes back to the pathology department, and they ship it off to the lab. So all of these labs that do the specialty testing have amazing patient support and doctor support. So if you have questions, you don't know how to handle it, you don't know how the kit gets there and what prep is needed, just call them. They are so helpful. And some of these tests are super expensive, and so you can always ask for a cash price for a patient who doesn't have insurance, and they all give big discounts. So those labs for the live cells are Wiesenthal Cancer Lab and Nagurny Cancer Institute. And I've given you the links to those. Though both those docs, Larry Wiesenthal and Robert Nagurny, happen to be in Los Angeles where I practice, so I know both of them. They actually used to have one lab, but too many chiefs in one place. So they each have their own lab now, and they do very similar work, but they're different personalities. They both are great. And Nagurny wrote a book for patients on why you do that kind of testing and why you look for a personalized plan for yourself when you've had a recurrence instead of doing standard of care. And I tell patients, we don't want to guess. We want to be precise. We don't want to throw a toxic drug at you if we don't know it's going to work. Why do that? We lose time, and then we also, you know, damage you. So I try to get patients to do this. And if we can do our therapies on them while we're waiting to get the results back, then the patient's not doing nothing, right? They're doing our protocol. They could do IV vitamin C, they could do mistletoe, you know, while they're waiting. So I also love this lab, consultative proteomics, and I talked extensively about this lab in another call. This lab is at the University of Texas, and it's a diagnostic lab. They do really leading edge work looking at the expressed proteins. So they're not looking at the genes, they're looking at the products of the genes. So that, remember that genes produce functional molecules. And so that tells you what genes are actually active and being expressed. So I think it's more valuable. If you just know the genes somebody has, you don't know if they're being expressed. So for example, with BRCA, you don't know if their BRCA mutation is actually affecting their cells or not. You just know they have the gene. So when you do proteomics, you know if the gene is being transcribed and producing its end product. So I feel this more useful. And one of my mentors, Dr. Reniker up in San Francisco, he's almost 80, he uses this lab extensively. And you can use frozen tissue for this. But remember, if there's frozen tissue, it can't be the tissue that was at the moment of diagnosis and then the patient had treatment, because by the time they're metastatic, they have transformed cells. The cells from the primary tumor aren't the cells that are growing anymore. So you need current cells to look at. Looking at the old cells that were gathered before all these changes happened isn't going to tell you which cells to treat. You have to find the growing cells that are the problem, present tense. And remember, in any patient, The primary tumor cells, present tense, are different than the cells that are in the metastatic satellites. So you have to decide where you're going to collect the cells from also. So usually do it where you can get them. Those are usually metastatic sites. So I love this lab, and I love them because they do this really groundbreaking work. They identify a few key molecules, and then they give you a report both on pharmaceutical and immunotherapy treatments and nutraceuticals and botanicals that will respond. So I love this. I love this, and they have great customer service. Foundation One's been around for a long time, and they keep expanding what they do. They're a very reliable lab, and they're now doing liquid biopsies as well as tumor analysis. So they've been around a long time, and a lot of doctors are familiar with that Foundation One. So if you ask the doctor to do a Foundation One analysis on a patient, they've heard of the lab. You know, it's been around a long time, whereas only leading-edge doctors have heard of consultative proteomics, for example. When you introduce them, I've introduced that lab to several oncologists I work with. They love it. Caris Life Sciences has also been around a long time, and they also do similarly. They look at the receptors, they look at the gene expression in the tumor cells, and they recommend treatment. They're both good labs. They're both really good labs. They're kind of going in different directions with their liquid biopsy offerings. Caris is looking at exosomes, and Foundations One is looking at other things. So you can look on their websites. And again, they love to talk to doctors and patients, so you can call them up. They'll talk to you and answer all your questions. We talked about liquid biopsies in other clinical calls, Grand Round calls, and Clinical Pearls. I have previously mentioned Guardant 360 Biocept as labs that I have used. And there's a new lab that I haven't used, but a number of my colleagues are using, called NeoGenomics. And I've looked at their site, and they do a lot of other analysis of tumors. So mostly where the oncologist is ordering a lot of the early tumor analyses. But if there's something specific you feel that should be ordered and you see that one of these reliable labs does it, you can have that conversation with the oncologist or just order it yourself if you're licensed to do so. You have to just know which tissue can you use, and is it current, and is there enough of it? So you first have to discern those things. If you don't have tissue, can you do something through the blood? Right. So do you have any questions about that, Aniko? Press star 7 if you want to ask anything. She's on the call. No, she was. She's not here anymore. Okay. So does anybody else want to ask about doing these sorts of tests in the instance of metastasis? Okie dokie. So let me just quickly bring to your attention the extra resources that I provided in the notes for you. The 2019 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium happens every year at the end of the year. Their slides are now on their website, and they're amazing, amazing education about breast cancer. And they have also slide sets that are just summaries, so you can learn a lot by just going through them. You don't have to listen to every lecture in its full length. So that's really fantastic information. There is a talk, a presentation, and paper in that those slides and in that program titled "Estrogen Decreases Breast Cancer Incidence in Postmenopausal Women. Estrogen plus Progestin has the opposite effect." So this article is about using estrogen in women to prevent breast cancer. So there is, I think it's worth looking at. There's a great paper, and I've given you the link to that. You can watch the little recording that summarizes the study also on the website. Then I've also provided a book that came out a couple years ago, but I think is well worth reading. It's called Estrogen Matters: Why Taking Hormones in Menopause Can Improve Women's Well-Being and Lengthen Their Lives Without Raising the Risk of Breast Cancer. So this is a book by a breast oncologist and his colleague, who happens to be a sociologist, about why women should use estrogen to prevent breast cancer. And it's pretty compelling. His arguments are pretty compelling. His studies are pretty compelling. And if you don't want to read the book, there's a fabulous podcast on the Peter Attia website, podcast site, which I love. Peter Attia, he's a brilliant doctor, does amazing interviews. So he interviewed these authors and they explain their rationale and their knowledge base, and they go through different diseases and risks and why estrogen is a good idea. So then I've provided you with another study that has the opposite point of view, and it was published in 2018, The Role of Estrogen in the Tumor Microenvironment. And this study states that estrogen not only binds to estrogen receptors and has a hormonal effect, but estrogen actually cripples the immune system in the tumor microenvironment. And so we have a completely different point of view here. And this article is showing that the M1 type protective tumor-associated macrophages and the anti-inflammatory cytokines are less present in the presence of oxygen, that anti-tumor quality is transformed into a pro-carcinogenic environment in the presence of estrogen because of its immune effects. So this study is comes to the opposite conclusion. And so I leave you with that paradox right there. If anyone wants to comment on either of those, it can certainly take a few moments to do so. Anybody want to ask or comment or say anything? All right. Thank you all for your attention and for hanging in there for this longer call. We went 15 minutes over. That's not too bad. And remember that if you want me to review a case, you have to get it to me in 2 weeks before the next call. I'm having surgery next month, so we're not going to have a call. And then I'll be all recovered, and we'll have a call in 2 months. So you have more time to get your cases together. I thank you for your attention and your participation and for your good hearts for taking care of cancer patients. Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye.